Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Natural History Museum of Utah at the Rio Tinto Center. I'm Sarah George, the Executive Director, and I am really pleased to see you all here this evening as we kick off our 2019 lecture series, Ancient Secrets, Hidden Worlds Revealed. The desire to seek the truth and discover answers to the unknown is as old as humankind. At this year's series, we invite you to meet four intrepid explorers who've traveled the globe and used the latest technologies in search of knowledge about long-ago cultures, civilizations, and our ancient ancestors. I want to thank a number of sponsors and partners who make it possible for the museum to host a series like this each year. We are particularly grateful to our founding underwriter, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, and our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund, for their tremendous and ongoing support of the series. We want to thank our gold sponsor, Rio Tinto Kennecott, and our silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DeFiore Family Foundation, the M. Lazy M. Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. I'd also like to acknowledge our media partner, KCPW 88.3 FM, and our community partners, the Benning Society of the University of Utah's School of Medicine, the City Library, our official airline, Delta and Aeromexico, Kingsbury Hall, Liberty Heights Fresh, and the County Library, the Viridian Events Center. And then finally, we really appreciate the voters of Salt Lake County. Your approval of the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund provides invaluable support for this museum, as well as many, many other cultural organizations across Salt Lake County. So please join me in thanking these incredible partners and supporters, including yourselves. So now to tonight's speaker, archaeologist and National Geographic explorer William Saturno received his PhD in anthropology from Harvard University in 2000. A specialist in Mesoamerican civilization and archaeological remote sensing, he's conducted fieldwork in the American Southwest, Bolivia, Cambodia, Peru, Mexico, Belize, Honduras, and Guatemala. In March 2001, while exploring northeastern Guatemala for Harvard's Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology, he discovered the remote archaeological site of San Bartolo and the oldest intact murals ever found in the Mayan world. Speaking on In Search of Ancient Maya, please welcome William Saturno.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out this evening. I'm really excited to be here. I haven't been to Salt Lake City for, I think, about 15 years, so it's really nice to be back. It's really beautiful. I haven't had any real snow back east, so I'm kind of excited that I'm going to get to see some here tomorrow. So that'll be great. It's an archaeology talk, so I have to start with a map, because all archaeology talks have to start with a map. And this is simply a map of the Maya area. It was produced by National Geographic a few years back, in which the Maya area you see shaded in sort of a pink, and a number of archaeological sites are sort of highlighted in different colors given the principal time periods that they were occupied. But it really wasn't that long ago, really only about 150 years ago, that a map of this area sort of showing archaeological sites would have just looked like this. The world of the ancient Maya was simply not well known to anyone outside of the region itself. Certainly the people living amongst the ruins were well aware that they were living among ruins. But beyond them, people simply weren't acquainted with the idea even of the ancient Maya. Now, in terms of, if we go further back than that, we can go back essentially exactly 500 years ago. It's great to be doing this in 2019, because in 1519, the idea of sort of celebrating exploration in 1519 is that that's the year, one, that Magellan sets off on the first circumnavigation of the globe. He doesn't make it, spoiler alert, but the one boat does make it back, piloted by Elcano. It takes him 3 years. But at the same time, 1519 was actually the year that the Spanish, particularly Cortes, became aware of what had been a prolonged contact with the ancient Maya. Beginning in 1511, there were actually two guys that survived shipwreck. Now, this is a map that you see. It's actually from the late 16th century. It's from 1594, but it's really colorful, so I chose it. It gives you a sense of where things are. This is, of course, Cuba. This is the Yucatan Peninsula. This is a place called Cape Catoche, which is actually the first battle that takes place between the Spanish and the Maya in 1517. So 2 years before the Spanish were broadly aware that there were actually two Spaniards living on the mainland, one by the name of Jerónimo de Aguilar and the other by the name of Gonzalo Guerrero. They were actually lost at sea, sailing from the Darien colony here, and they were shipwrecked off the coast. They actually essentially drift over a number of weeks. The great majority of people die en route. A number of them are killed immediately upon landing. But Guerrero and Aguilar go on to live two very different lives over the next decade. Aguilar is a slave and essentially maintains his Spanishness. Right? He maintains his celibacy, despite what he tells us that they made lots of pleasant offers. He essentially keeps track of the daily events, keeping his book of hours, right? Essentially tracking his sort of Christian prayers throughout an 8-year period. He was off by a couple of days at the end. Guerrero, on the other hand, actually goes native. Guerrero is tattooed. He has his ears pierced, great big plugs. He actually becomes a war captain and is widely regarded as the one suggesting the ambush of the Spanish in 1517. They didn't know that there was one of their own behind it, but he goes on to continue to fight against the Spanish until his death in the 1520s. He's actually killed in Honduras. So he gets around quite a bit simply fighting against the Spanish. Now, the reason that Cortes became aware of this is he actually docks a boat for repair off the coast of the Yucatan, the island of Cozumel. And while he's there having his ships repaired, he hears the rumor that there are bearded men living on the mainland. And for me, this is one of the most remarkable things that ever took place, is that he decides to send a letter. Yeah, let that sink in. A letter and a ransom of green glass beads. And he essentially sends this to the mainland and says, deliver this to the bearded guy. And it takes 2 days. 2 days for the letter to be received by Jerónimo de Aguilar, who is a slave in captivity. He receives this letter with a ransom, and he says to his master, hey, can I go free? And they say, sure. And they give him the beads. He takes some of the ransom, and he goes free. The idea that you could send a letter 2 days to the guy with the beard somewhere on the mainland, and it would get there. Like, I live in Connecticut. I can't get a letter to New York City, which is actually 2 hours away. It could take 2-3 weeks. Aguilar, though, imagine how excited he would have been to be rescued, right? This idea that there's a Spanish ship waiting offshore for him. And he decides not to go because he refuses to leave without first making contact with his brother Guerrero. So he makes an effort to find Guerrero. and he heads further south in this quest to find Gedetto, and he finds him. And when he finds Gedetto, it's this great interaction, and we have the text from Aguilar's report of their interaction. And Gedetto, he's like, Gedetto, we're rescued. And Gedetto says, nah, I'm good. He, in fact, says to him, look at me. I'm tattooed. My ears are pierced. What would my brothers think of me in this guise? Besides, look at my boys. He has children. Look how wonderful they are. Said, so do me a favor. Leave the beads. I love this. No, I'm not coming, but leave the beads. I will give them to my sons and say that they were a gift from my brothers from far away, from where I'm from. And so Aguilar leaves the beads and goes back in order to leave. And when he gets to the place where he's supposed to meet his boat, his little cayuco that's supposed to row him back out to Cozumel, they're gone. Now, this is a real roller coaster for Aguilar, right? He's like, I'm a slave, I'm rescued. Aguilar tells him, no thank you, I've been abandoned. He actually uses the only remaining beads that he has, and he hires a boat to take him out to meet the ship. And he goes, is rescued by Cortez, and then continues on as his translator from then on. Now, the sad thing is that we don't actually have really extensive records from Aguilar's experience. The idea that this is a man that lived for nearly a decade in a Maya community on the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula from 1511, when he washes up as a shipwreck victim, and until 1519 when he leaves. Right? We don't ever hear from Guerrero other than this interaction. The interaction with Guerrero's wife, by the way, was much less amicable, because she just says, who are you, slave, talking to my husband? Because although Guerrero and Aguilar see themselves as equals, despite going off in very different directions, as far as Guerrero's wife is concerned, her husband is a war captain, this man is a slave. The fact that they have some history together means nothing. Go away, she says, and bother us no more with your words. So we're going to fast forward a little from then, because the moment when the Western world, certainly the United States and Western Europe, becomes keenly aware of the ancient Maya actually dates to the middle of the 19th century. And it was really because of an individual named Stevens, John Lloyd Stevens, and his illustrator friend, Frederick Catherwood. And this is one of Catherwood's illustrations of Stila from the site of Copan. And Stevens, sort of a prodigy, he graduated from Columbia in his early teens. He got a law degree and had a successful law career in New York and got bored and decided he wanted to sort of see the world. He becomes inadvertently famous while he's away because he writes letters home from all of these places that he's visiting in the old world. And he sends these letters home to his friends and family. And he's a truly gifted writer. And his friends and his family decide to submit these letters to the local papers. And so they're published, and it becomes a sort of running series of letters from Stevens that are published in the New York papers for years before he returns. So he sort of comes back to New York, and everyone knows who he is. He's sort of the first blogger, I guess, in that regard, right? I mean, he's literally just recording everything he's doing. On those excursions, he meets Catherwood, and the two of them eventually go together to Central America. And Stevens' text, when it was published, it's a series of four volumes, when it was first published in the early 1840s, it is an absolute bestseller. It goes through 11 printings in the first year. It, in fact, was outsold by only one book in the United States, which was the Bible. Right? If you are on a bestseller list and it's two people long and one of them is God, you've done pretty well for yourself. So people read this book. They see these engravings, these lithographs that Catherwood has done. And this world of the Maya, located so close to the United States, simply comes to life. It comes to life in the spectacular prose of Stevens and the wonderful drawings of Catherwood. Now, Stevens asks a series of questions. And what's remarkable is that these are essentially the same kinds of questions that archaeologists are still asking today about the ancient Maya. Essentially, who built these cities? Who ruled over them? And how did they fall into ruin? Those are the very questions that I look to answer today. Now, also interestingly, Stevens made a couple of really important leaps that didn't necessarily catch on right away. One was he was one of the very first people to suggest that the ancient Maya were in fact related to the modern Maya. Now, that may not seem like a big leap, but the idea prevalent at the time was that most of these places must have been built by some migrant from the old world. And so Stevens, in the first volume, says we don't know who made these. But in the second volume, he's very clear and says there's absolutely no reason to look any farther than the not-so-distant ancestors of the people living here today. He was, of course, dead on. The other thing that he suggests is that their history is graven on its monuments. Now, although he writes this in 1840s, it wasn't until the middle of the 20th century that the idea that the ancient Maya were in fact a historical people, that the monuments, which were covered with these hieroglyphics recorded by Catherwood and others, told us more than simply dates and numbers, but actually contained the historical events of the lives of the people that lived in these great cities. Now, it seems sort of wild that for 100 years, and it certainly wasn't for that entire 100 years, there were always proponents saying early in the 20th century, by about 1920, it had sort of worn off, that these are probably historical, but we just can't read them, to the 1950s when it was, these are simply not historical. In fact, the most prominent Maya epigrapher at the time, Thompson, stated that it was well nigh inconceivable that a single historical person had ever been mentioned. That's a pretty bold statement. To be like, yeah, there's all of these writings. We're pretty sure there are no people on them ever. And that was really the most common idea at the time. Remarkably, here we have an image of the bishop Diego de Landa. And Landa is often sort of vilified as the burner of Maya books, as having destroyed all the records that the Maya had. Now, certainly the Maya, we know that the Maya recorded their writings in books. There are only four Maya books that still preserve to this day. We don't actually know exactly when they were written down. It seems that they were likely written some as late as the 15th century, others perhaps as early as the 11th or 12th century. But of those four books, it's sort of like we only have four left. There were tens of thousands, and Landa burned all of them. He certainly burned books. He burned books in an auto de fe. As a way of essentially, he couldn't read them. And so the idea, and this happened all over the world, not just in the Maya area, the idea of a people that has been conquered or is being conquered, being able to communicate with each other across a distance in a written language that you can't read, simply strikes you as the conqueror as dangerous. It's also a fact that, you know, the idea was, since you don't know what's written, it could be about anything. And so, of course, it certainly seemed to Landa that a lot of this was likely blasphemous and thus should be destroyed. He comments, in fact, on how the Maya wept as their books were heaved into the fire. Certainly the great majority of Maya books deteriorated on their own. They simply dissolved over time. They weren't all burned by Landa. Ironically, the reason that we can read Maya hieroglyphic text today is because of Landa. Landa having been called back to Spain to appear before the Spanish Inquisition because of excessive cruelty, right? Like, yeah, you know you're not doing something right if the Inquisition's like, yeah, it seems a little excessive, because they weren't really known as a sort of forward-thinking PC kind of group, right? The idea that Landa has to go back to Spain, and he writes out the treatise, essentially defending his actions by relating all of the events that have transpired in the Yucatan. And one page in this treatise is this page that you see before you, which contained what for many years people referred to as Landa's alphabet, right? In which individual signs, he interpreted them as letters. Now, this was a fault of translation, right? This was an error in translation. Essentially, Landa asking local informants, ¿Cómo se escribe A? How do you write the letter A? Is told how to write the sound A. ¿Cómo se escribe B? How do you write the letter B? And they tell him how to write the sound B. But of course, Landa is confined by his knowledge of writing, right? And so he doesn't ask nearly enough questions, because having asked how you write A and how you write B, he's working under the assumption that you can put B and A together and make ba, except you can't, because the Maya actually wrote as a syllabary. Right? They wrote as a series of sounds. So the vowels work fine, but they didn't have consonants. They have consonant-vowel pairs. So if you ask, ¿Cómo se escribe B? He can tell you how to write B. In this instance, he actually tells them how to write both B and B, right? As though he didn't quite get what he said. It's like, was that B, B? We write them this way, right? But Landa could never actually put them together to make words. Very frustrating. The one word that we have written here is actually very funny, and it derives from a moment when Landa is asking the scribe to write something down, and the scribe tells him he does not want to. And he's like, write it down, I don't want to. Write it down, and he does. And what he writes is ma in kati, which is I don't want to. Now, the decipherment, the leap between, one, the idea that this is history comes from a woman named Titania Proskuryakov, who couldn't read the text but was able to identify patterns in the text, which she thought were human names, right? They occurred for periods of a human lifetime, and then they would be replaced contextually by another series of independent glyphs. And so she made the leap that those represented human lives and the events they were talking about. The earliest one would be their birth, and the last one would be their death, and the things in between would be the events in their life. Spectacular contribution. The contribution identifying this as a syllabary actually comes from a Russian iconographer named Yuri Konorosov. And this is a picture of Yuri. It's one of the only pictures that exists of him. I don't know if it's just because it was right before he turned into a vampire and that no other pictures exist for that reason. But he was the one that actually made the leap that said, these aren't letters, these are syllables. And that sets us on the way to the near full decipherment of Maya hieroglyphic text, which is where we find ourselves today. Almost 90% of Maya hieroglyphic text can now be read. Unfortunately, one of the problems with Maya hieroglyphic text is that it's beautiful. And because it's beautiful, it is often essentially the victim of illicit excavation and looting. This piece was actually cut into four pieces to facilitate its movement. It resides in a museum in Texas. And the reason I point this out is because you really sort of needed, at a certain point in the 1960s and especially the 70s, it became very common for these materials to disappear, for organized crews of looters to go into remote archaeological sites in the Maya world with newly acquired excavation techniques and trench through buildings to find tombs and pots and jade, and to saw the faces off of the carved hieroglyphic monuments that had stood there for centuries. They were too heavy to move as a whole, so they would simply use later chainsaws, but originally just two-handed tree saws, like two-man tree saws, to essentially saw off the faces of these things. This really created a situation where these materials were simply disappearing. Items that had been recorded by archaeologists in the 1920s were missing in the 1970s. And one individual, we sort of needed someone, right, that was willing to sort of brave this environment, not only to just sort of be out there in the jungle by themselves for months at a time in order to record these, but essentially to brave being shot at, right? Looters didn't want to be caught. They're doing illegal things, right? To be down there, you needed a hero, essentially, to do that. And of course, that wasn't actually the hero. That was the hero. This is a guy by the name of Ian Graham. Ian Graham was the person that I always wanted to be. I didn't want to be like Ian. I wanted to be Ian. And if you want to read an absolutely spectacular memoir about a guy who was the boyhood pen pal of Rudyard Kipling, right, who hung out in New York with Picasso, who at one point was driving the Rolls Royce of Lawrence of Arabia, right? This is a guy that led a very full life. But he decided that his true mission in life, his calling, was going to be that hero, was going to be the guy to brave the environment and to brave the looters and to be out there and record, both with photography and illustration, these Maya hieroglyphic monuments before they vanished. He founded a project called the Corpus of Maya Hieroglyphic Inscriptions out of the Peabody Museum at Harvard University, and he received a MacArthur Genius Award for his efforts. He could never actually read the writing himself. That wasn't his purpose. He figured other people would be able to read it, but they wouldn't have anything to read if he wasn't out there saving it. In 2001, Ian Graham was sort of looking to retire from his service. And as he put it, he was looking for someone young and foolish to take up the charge. And of course, always having wanted to be Ian, I was one of the first to apply. He later told me that he received a number of younger applicants, but no one that could match my foolishness. And so Ian actually sent me out on a sort of test mission for the Corpus Project. I was supposed to go to Guatemala, and there were two places that I was supposed to visit. One was a site near the town of Dos Lagunas, where he had been 20 years earlier. But looters had been close by, and he had not been able to fully document a monument, but had instead decided to bury it. And he wanted to know if that monument was still there. The second location I was supposed to go was an archaeological site named Notch Toon, which is in the very... Notch Toon, by the way, was named by Morley as the faraway stone, just to give you a sense that it was probably not close to anything. I was supposed to visit Notch Toon, where recent looting had uncovered a new hieroglyphic monument. And so I was supposed to... I had 2 weeks. I essentially pieced together 2 weeks... around spring break for my first year of teaching at the University of New Hampshire. I was going to do that first week to go to Dos Lagunas, and the second week I was going to go to the site of Notch Toon, simply to take some photographs, try not to get killed by the looters, and just sort of be nice, say, I don't care about what you're doing, I just want to take a couple pictures, and so there's a record of it. And so that was my mission. And so I flew down to Guatemala with a very specific mission in mind. And he actually suggested that I hire a local guide, a guy that lived next door to him on Lake Pitanitza in Guatemala. His name was Bernie Mittelstadt. Now, I know that Bernie Mittelstadt does not sound like a local guide in Guatemala, but he's Guatemalan. He's obviously of German descent, Guatemala. But Ian also, he had a warning to go with that. He's like, you should definitely hire Bernie. He has excellent vehicles. I wouldn't trust him, though. I'm pretty sure he's involved in the looting. It's like, great news. So I went down to Bernie and I are actually friends now. It's fine. But at the time, what did I know? And so I went down and I hired Bernie. And the first thing he says to me is, yeah, we can't go to Dos Lagunas. There's not enough time. I was like, okay, then I should probably head up to Notch Tune. He was like, yeah, you can't go to Notch Tune. Like, all right, that's sort of a bummer. I said, well, you know, well, why not? Not enough time? He's like, well, no. So actually, what I was supposed to do was I was supposed to sort of hitch a ride, my understanding, on a mule train into El Mirador with Richard Hansen, who is here tonight. Richard was, however, not in Guatemala at that time, and so I needed to wait for Richard to get back before I could hitch a ride on a mule train. And so I had a week, essentially, when I couldn't go to Dos Lagunas and I couldn't go to Notch Tune, where I was sitting, twiddling my thumbs, lamenting my failure as a person working for the corpus of Maya hieroglyphic inscriptions, when Bernie suggested an alternative. He suggested a place that was only 3 hours away. A place where recent looting had uncovered three, count them, three, new carved hieroglyphic monuments. We could leave in the morning, he would make all of the preparations, and we would head off. I was like, perfect. It's within the realm of the corpus of Maya hieroglyphic inscriptions. I can't go to Notch Tune for another week. Sounds great. It's better than sitting around waiting to do something. So the next morning, we headed off from Ian's house in order to find the site of San Bartolo. We've come to that. The first thing I wanted to say, though, before we got to that, is one of the great things about being able to read Maya hieroglyphic texts is that now not only do we have the dates and the people's names and just the simple events of their lives, but we can really start to sort of dig into the relationships between individuals. And we can really start to understand the ancient Maya are not so dissimilar from us. One sort of story that I love takes place between two brothers, actually half-brothers, from Tikal, one by the name of Bachlach Chan Kahuil, and the other, sort of noble name, Nun Oholchak. And the two of them are half-brothers. Now, we've already passed the whole sort of season of getting together with family, but if I ask you just for a moment to think, just to yourselves, just think to yourself of that relative, right? You all have one. You've all thought in your head, like, oh, the person that I don't really want to see at Thanksgiving, the person that I don't necessarily want to come visit or have to spend a lot of time with over the holidays. And I would also say that if you can't think of a person, it may be you. But nonetheless, these two half-brothers certainly did not get along. Both of them become kings of essentially rival kingdoms, right? Tikal has been conquered. Tikal has actually been conquered by the distant power of Calakmul, and his rival half-brother sets up a kingdom in Dos Pilas with the support of Calakmul. Right? Now, there's an event in which the king of Calakmul is actually having a celebration in which he's going to name the heir to his throne, essentially the new overlord that will be the overlord of both brothers. And both brothers are invited to attend. That this event did not go well for the brothers is borne out by the fact that not long after that, the brother from Tikal goes to war with the brother from Dos Pilas, and essentially not just your normal sort of let's take some captives war, but a war in which he single-handedly goes to find him and burns the city that he's living in. He escapes, and so he burns the next one and the next one. He essentially follows him around, burning every place he goes until Calakmul eventually intervenes and Tikal itself is defeated once again. Now, the phrase describing Tikal's defeat is my single favorite phrase ever written in Maya hieroglyphs. It is Nach Bach Uch Ich Witz Ach Ucholil, which means, for those that didn't understand that, blood was pooled, heads were piled up. It is gruesome. It is grisly. It is also in passive voice. No one has actually taken responsibility for this, right? It's very governmental, right? It sounds like I'm not saying I did it. I'm just saying that blood may have pooled. And heads, as it turned out, got piled. In addition to being very governmental, being Italian-American myself, it also has a very sort of forget-about feel, a very New Jersey mob, Tony Soprano feel to it, which I'm very fond of. So back to my journey. So my journey for the corpus was about trying to essentially find new stories to tell about the ancient Maya, right? To be able to find new people to talk about, on new monuments that had not been seen before. And so my journey begins from Ian's house on the lake. This is just a satellite image of Paten. It was to pass through the site of Tikal, and then on the winding road, 23 kilometers north to Washaktun. And from Washaktun, we were supposed to head off into the forest on a dirt track to the site of Shultun. And I really regret not having taken a picture of this, because there used to be a sign in Washaktun that pointed to where Shultun was. And it said, Shultun, 40 kilometers. Camino en mal estado, road in bad shape. Now, when I approached this sign in 2001, the sign was broken and the arrow was pointing straight down, which probably should have been my first indication that I was about to take a trip to hell. Now, the idea that this the road was in bad shape when the sign was new was sort of like, huh, I probably should have thought about that. But instead, off we headed. It was supposed to be a 3-hour tour. For fans of Gilligan's Island, you know how that pans out. It was not a 3-hour tour. In fact, the journey from Washaktun to Shultun took us a bit more than the time planned. Mainly because this was the road. It's actually the part of the road that looked clear enough for me to take a picture of the vehicle in front of me. That's Bernie's vehicle, by the way. It is an excellent vehicle. Not long after that picture, we came upon a tree that had fallen in the forest. There's a problem with this, is that we weren't entirely prepared for this eventuality. Now, you want to say, if you're going to go exploring in the jungle, you should probably have some basic equipment like a chainsaw. We did not. We did have a chain, which is not nearly as useful. We also had two machetes. There were 6 men. For anyone that spent any time in Guatemala, that's 4 machetes short, right? Because no self-respecting man or woman would go into the Guatemalan forest without their trusty machete. It's an extension of their arm. So the idea that we had 2 of them to split didn't really work out. We were unable to move this tree. I don't know why he thought he'd be able to. So instead, we had to cut a new path around it. And so we did that. And had that been the only tree we had found, we probably still would have arrived more or less on time. Any betting people in the audience? Because if you're willing to bet, the number of trees, I don't remember exactly, but it's either 16 or 18. There was a lot of trees. And it takes us 12 and a half hours, essentially, to cut a brand new road all the way to the site of Shultun. We get to Shultun at night. This is our camp. This is my hammock and pabayon, a mosquito net. I love this picture because this picture actually contains all of our supplies. There is a can of beans, a jar of cheese, that is not okay, and at the very bottom of the frame is one bottle of hot sauce. You'll notice there's no water in this picture. It's because we didn't have any water. The next morning, we had decisions to make. We had to decide what we would do. And this is how discovery happens. The way you make a spectacular discovery is you're an idiot. But you can't just be a run-of-the-mill idiot. You have to be truly committed to your own idiocy. Right? So that at every opportunity, when you have the chance to turn back, when you have a chance to resupply or to do the smart thing, you say, what could happen? We seem so close. We should continue forward. And you do. There are those that say we got lost in the forest. We did not get lost because I had a GPS. And I knew exactly where I was every moment of our trip. The problem is that we didn't actually know where we were going, because we were actually following a rumor. And as you may know, you all have GPSs now, you can't input a rumor into a GPS and get any sort of reliable result. And so the rumor was that this new site with three carved hieroglyphic monuments was 6 kilometers north of Shultun. So we set off to find it. We ended up walking 22 kilometers and spent 9.5 hours walking in all directions before eventually walking north. We started our trip 3 kilometers to the west, then followed it up with 9 kilometers to the east, netting about 100 meters north and having walked for a good part of the day, as you can imagine. At the end of this trip, we find an archaeological site. And as I get to the end of the talk, when you see all of the archaeological sites in the area, you'll realize how remarkable a journey it was that we could spend that much time walking in the forest without finding an archaeological site. I mean, to plot the route that we took to avoid all of the sites between Shultun and San Bartolo was really miraculous. But we were able to do it because that's how committed to my idiocy I was. At the end of the day, we arrive at a new site, San Bartolo, that's what they told me it was called, named on the day it was Chiclero had found it, 24th of August, the day of San Bartolo. And when I arrived there, there were no carved hieroglyphic monuments. So 3 less than anticipated. Not a lot to take pictures of, certainly nothing to complete the mission of the corpus with. And so now 2 days into a 3-hour tour, we have no food, no water, and are now, as the crow flies, 8 kilometers from our vehicles, but by the path we took, 22 kilometers away. The other members of the party decide to go off and find water. They've been assuring me all day that this is the jungle and there are vines and you can cut them open and you can shower in the water that pours forth. Like, okay, if there are shower vines, I mean, what's the danger? So they went off to find shower vines and I decided to essentially hide in a hole. That's what I did. There was a looter's excavation at the site, a very large looter's tunnel that went into the backside of a great big pyramid. The pyramid's about 26 meters tall. And I really went in there just to get out of the sun, just essentially because I thought that it would be cooler in there than it would be in the middle of March in Paten. So I went in essentially in total darkness, into a tunnel. I didn't really give much thought to what I was doing. I just thought it'd be nicer in there than it was outside. I sat down in a large pile of bat droppings. That added to my day. And I actually turned on a headlamp at that point to look over my head to see if there were any bats, really just to see if they were going to further add to the joy that was my day as I sat moping and bat feces in a dark hole in the middle of Guatemala, lamenting how I was certainly no Ian Graham, and that this was certainly my one and only mission for the Corpus Project. When I shone that light up on the ceiling above me, this is actually what I saw. So I would really love to have had that aha moment that all of you just had. I didn't. My reaction to this was, nice. Because in my mind, seeing this was just another sign of how horrible my day was going. Because A, he might be involved with the looting, and B, my idea was, I'm clearly going to die right here in front of this. Folks have asked me since then, did you feel like Indiana Jones at that moment? I was like, nope. I never felt like Indiana Jones. Never once. I did, however, feel like, if anyone's seen the Indiana Jones movies, an archaeologist by the name of Forrestal. Forrestal is the guy that Indy discovers in the first film when he puts his hand out into the light and the spears shoot out from the wall and there's a corpse on the spears and he says, Forrestal, he got so close. Yeah, I was Forrestal. Right? I'm like, I'm going to die and Indy will find this and me in front of it 20 years from now. That's how I envisioned this story ending. It, of course, didn't end that way. To put the discovery in a little bit of perspective, the last time an extensive mural program had been found in the Maya lowlands was 1946. So 55 years had passed. Those paintings at the site of Bonampak in Mexico, in Chiapas, date to 798 AD. These paintings date between the 1st and 2nd century BC. They're about 1,000 years older than Bonampak. And so it was a pretty remarkable thing just to be in front of it. I had really no idea what would happen next, as over the next decade, we began a project to investigate and preserve the paintings that we saw. Interestingly, this individual is a shaman from the Maya community of Santiago Atitlan that came to San Bartolo on a pilgrimage in 2006. And when he came to San Bartolo, he told me the story of its discovery. And his version of the story of the discovery of San Bartolo is different than mine. And I'm much cooler in his. So I like his version better. In his version, I suffered on this journey to San Bartolo, and I died. In death, I entered into the underworld in the form of this tunnel. While in the underworld, dead, mind you, I was visited by the Maya gods and was allowed to return to the world of the living by the maize god, provided that I brought this story with me, that I brought the sacred knowledge that I would receive in the underworld to the Maya living today. I told you in their story, I'm really cool. In my story, I'm a buffoon that gets not lost, but lost in the jungle and sits in bat droppings and finds something remarkable. And theirs, I get to commune with gods, get resurrected, and bring sacred knowledge back to the Maya. The murals of San Bartolo are really spectacular. The idea that these were painted in a relatively small Maya community in the 1st or 2nd century BC is just mind-blowing. And the story that they tell, right? There are no monuments, no hieroglyphic, carved hieroglyphic monuments for me to tell the story of but I can tell the story of creation, because the events that take place on the walls at San Bartolo show essentially the organization of the world that we live in before the establishment of our first kingdoms. When the patron deity of kings, the son of the maize god, makes a sacrifice of his own blood and a series of offerings, right? He offers a fish, he offers a fish in the water, he offers a deer on land, he offers a turkey in the sky, and he offers the scent of flowers, incense, in the sort of floral paradise of the east where the sun would eventually be born. He does all that as a precursor to a series of ceremonies that result in the crowning of a Maya king, seated upon a wooden scaffold, attended by an individual climbing a ladder, handing him his crown, a crown, by the way, that iconographically is reproduced for the next 900 years as a symbol of the taking the office of the kingship, and even accompanied by an early hieroglyphic text. We cannot read it in its entirety. It essentially predates the period in which we're literate. But the end of that text concludes with two glyphs which say, Kuhul Ahau, Holy Lord, the same title used by Maya kings for a millennium after. Keeping this mural intact and in situ was a 10-year project involving conservators both from Guatemala, from Italy, and from the United States. In addition to the paintings that were on the walls, the Maya actually destroyed half of this painting in antiquity when they built a new building over the top. And there are currently more than 5,000 fragments of this painting that have been put back together and are now part of the permanent exhibit of the National Museum of Archaeology in Guatemala City. From San Bartolo, I went south. I went back to Xoltun, right? The place where I had sort of camped out at the beginning. Xoltun was actually found in the 19-teens. It was found as a result of this posted advertisement offering $25 in gold to any gum resin harvester that could locate a Maya archaeological site with carved hieroglyphic monuments. And Xoltun was one of those sites, found by Aurelio Aguayo in 1915 and visited by Sylvanus Morley, the person who posted the advertisement, in 1920. In 2010, one of my undergraduate students that came down for a field study program, a semester abroad in Guatemala, came down with the express purpose of finding a mural. He was like, "You found one. It can't be that hard." I told him that if he wanted to find a mural, the thing to do was to be part of the survey crew, be part of the crew that was the first to go into all the looters' excavations to map the site that they were going to be visiting. And so he spent every lunch hour at the site of Xoltun poking his head into countless looters' excavations in order to find a painting, and this is what he found. I know it's not as nice as the one I just showed you, but nonetheless, you can see there's a couple of lines. And for him, it was magnificent. I went out to see it, and I thought, okay. Well, there's not really much to see, Max. I'm sorry. But the least we can do is run a couple of test excavations to see how big the room is. We can say that it was painted, right, in antiquity, and it was this big. You know, it seemed to be part of a household, not actually part of any sort of ceremonial complex. So the context of it was also sort of interesting. It was a small building. It was about 2 meters tall, right? And so I excavated about 30 centimeters to find the back wall of the room. And when I did, this is what I found. The curse of finding murals has stayed with me. Richard had suggested to me that there might be a place in the Mirador Basin where I might find more murals. You couldn't pay me to find more murals. They're great to find, they're spectacular, and they provide us with a level of information that we can't get anywhere else, but they are costly and time-consuming, and I can't look up as a result of having excavated too many of them. This building is an odd structure. It's just a room with a bench in it, located really on the outskirts of the central plaza at Xoltun. But it houses a portrait of the king, and the king is surrounded by a series of individuals, all interacting with him in a ceremony. And we know the date of that ceremony in 762 AD, but we don't actually know exactly what's going on. Interestingly, the most fascinating part of this room doesn't necessarily come from the big pictures or the scene that we're looking at, but in fact from small bits of text written, effaced, and rewritten, corrected, written again on the walls. Not part of the main body of the mural, right? Not part of the narrative of this ceremony, but are in fact just little notations. These are a series of numbers, some big, some small, some very large. This one is actually around, in the third column, is about 2.7 million It's counting days, actually. But the remarkable thing about these columns is that all of them are multiples of the same sets of numbers. They're, in fact, multiples of the Maya calendar. They're multiples of the 19,890-day Maya calendar, that 52-year calendar round. These are all even multiples of that. They're also multiples of the 584-day cycle of Venus, the 173-day cycle of Mercury, and the 780-day cycle of Mars. They're a bizarre set of numbers, but it gives us a hint. I've never seen anything like this on a wall before. It gives us a hint of the types of thoughts they're having in this room, the types of things that they're sort of writing on the board. This is like a whiteboard that they're sort of playing with. On the wall next to it is another table. And this one we were able to really understand. It's a series of days that are just added together. But the periods of days being added are all 177 days, which is actually the period that the Maya use to calculate the period of the moon. The top of each of these columns is actually a hieroglyph of the moon. It was pointed out by David Stewart. And the numbers actually are all these sort of cumulative addition of moon cycles. They add 177 days to 177 days over and over and over and over again. But that doesn't quite, the reason they did this is the Maya didn't love fractions, right? And the way they got around fractions was through multiplication, right? So the period of the moon is about 29 and a half days. And so they would multiply it by six. They would deal with lunar, essentially, semesters of 177 days. But if you're trying to track the moon, that's not exactly right. It's sort of like our leap year, right? And so what they did was every sixth one, they added an extra day, 178 days. And this table actually records from the first, essentially, 13 years of a lunar model written down in the 8th century. And the archaeoastronomer Tony Avini said about this that, you know, the remarkable thing about it is every place else in the world where they study the stars, right, and the planets, we have access to the scientists' notebooks. But in the Maya world, we don't. This room is our first access to those, to them acquiring that knowledge. The only other places we've ever seen tables like this are remarkably in the books that are preserved. Right? Of those four books that are preserved from sometime in the 12th to 15th century, we end up with the very same tables, right? Those very same multiples and the very same sort of planning of the lunar cycle. In the Dresden Codex, when they deal with the moon, they add 177 days and 177 days and 177 days, and they don't add the 178s. What they figured out sometime between when that was painted on a wall at Schultun and when it was written down in a Dresden Codex is that that 30-day period between 148 and 178 in the sixth lunation is the only time you can have an eclipse. That's the only time. And so what they're doing in the Dresden Codex is they're using that 148 to predict that 30 days where the eclipse is possible. And on this wall in the 8th century, they're essentially playing with that same information. The other part of this room is the other people on the wall, on this wall, that are all dressed alike. Often, if you take a look at any at Maya paintings on vases, people dress differently. They're shown at court, right, in their costume, in the thing that they wear to court. They all have different headdresses. They all have different, you know, loincloths. They all hold different spears and all sorts of identifying characteristics. In this instance, all of the guys on the wall of this room are all painted exactly the same. Right? They're all wearing a white loincloth. They're all covered in black. They have only this sort of white diadem on their chest and in their headdress with that single red feather. The individual on the far side here is actually labeled as Sahuntach. It means the older brother Obsidian. And that title is something that we actually see elsewhere in the Maya world. And it's associated with essentially teachers. Right? They're guys that are in charge of essentially minding the noble youths. And the guys that we see next to them are actually labeled with the word chok, meaning youth. So this sort of older brother Obsidian, and these Obsidians painted in black is also cool, the sort of black volcanic glass. But these guys, it's a special paint, because not only are they painted black, they're actually painted black that is mixed with specular hematite, right, which has little flecks of essentially ore in it, mica in it. And it sort of reflects the light, so it shimmers and glimmers in torchlight. So these aren't just black obsidians. These are sparkly black obsidians. The room was essentially terminated at the end of the 8th century, and when it was, there was a burial placed behind the building under the floor. It was a relatively simple burial. It was here being excavated by a former graduate student, now teaching at University of Illinois Chicago, Franco Rossi. And when Franco excavated it, you can see that it's not a terribly wealthy tomb. It just has the one bowl north of the head. But the remarkable thing about it is that it has only two other artifacts in it, two discs in white plaster. One pierced for suspension around the neck, and one not pierced to be placed in a headdress, right? The guys on the wall are the guy under the floor. Like, rarely do you ever get that type of connection archaeologically between the individuals that are using a space, that are making those calculations, that are painting the walls, that are essentially either copying material out of books or writing materials into books, that are associated with the training of youths. Do we get to see them then buried under the floor with the only artifacts that we know them to be associated with in the paintings? Now, what is there to find? And the last couple of images that I wanted to show have to do with the LIDAR mission that's been run in Guatemala beginning in 2016, which you've all heard about in the news. The National Geographic did a big special on it. But I just wanted to highlight some of the images around San Bartolo and Xoltun. Right? The site of San Bartolo is located up here, the site of Xoltun down below. I'll go back to San Bartolo. This is the LIDAR image of San Bartolo, in which we can see essentially all of the architectural structures, even the smaller materials. You can see roadways heading off to other settlement further to the north. It's really quite remarkable. Now, we began mapping Xoltun year after year after year after year, as that map slowly but surely grew incrementally. We weren't just mapping, obviously, we were conducting excavations. This is where that mural was from. There are, of course, burials associated with that, as well as other burials and friezes and other structures that were of interest. But with the LIDAR pass, all of a sudden, we get the whole site of Xoltun all at once. And we had done reconnaissance out into the distance to see that we had settlement 7, 8, 10 kilometers away, still in sort of urban density. But now, with LIDAR, all those little dark dots, that's all Xoltun. And this complex, for which there's actually a causeway that leads out towards it, is one of the largest at the site, and it's about 5 kilometers away. So in terms of what's out there, the images that I showed you, those paintings, one of them comes from, you know, a building, a single building at a site with about 200 structures at it. That other one comes from a building from Xoltun that's 2 meters tall from a site with thousands of structures at it. The number of those possibly being there, even at the site of Xoltun, means that generations of Mayanists would be dealing only with this site. And this isn't the biggest site. And it's not the most important site. And it's not even close to being the earliest sites. When you think about the enormous amount of data that was acquired essentially instantly that will essentially drive all of the future Ian Grahams and their idiot followers into the forest to verify these things, and all of the Max Chamberlains that just wanted to poke their heads into a looter's tunnel, find a painting, and then essentially retire from the archaeological world. He writes music. But if you think about how many of these things are out there and how far our knowledge has come from those very first incursions to now, think about what the next decade holds. Think about what the next century has to say about the ancient Maya. How in depth we can come, what we can understand, not just about the historical events that surround them, but the intimate details of their daily lives that perhaps are recorded on things as ephemeral as a very small piece of wall with just some doodles. More for the future. Thank you.
Thank you. That was marvelous. We have two microphones, one in the center and one right here. We want to take 10 to 15 minutes for questions. If you would line up the microphones, we'll just go back and forth between the two. So,
and if there are no questions, I'm going to have to dance. I'm not really going to dance.
So a quick question from an observation from your last slide with the LIDAR.
Uh-huh.
From that, we can see a few water features. How significant were water features in the mountainous area as indicators of civilization?
Maya civilization is, by and large, essentially a water civilization, right? I mean, you can't have settlement, and certainly dense urban settlement, without being able to control the sort of hydrologic regime. And Maya cities through time practiced different techniques at essentially trying to maintain that environment. They start out essentially settling in lower-lying areas, probably because of perennial water features that were there already, but also sort of taking advantage of the fact that water is going to flow into those areas. They change that method and change cities from essentially being concave to being convex so that they can essentially control the flow of water and to be collected in various reservoirs rather than being inundated in a way that might be less controllable. And so certainly a Maya city like Xaltun, which is by and large a classic period city. I mean, the earliest settlement there is around 500 BC, but it becomes large from what we can see in around the 3rd, 4th century AD. And from that point on, they are building reservoirs, and they are channeling water into those reservoirs, and they're creating a drainage environment that will continue to fill them and maintain a water-rich environment throughout the year, in addition to essentially manipulating the areas around perennial wetlands in order to plant, essentially terracing the margins.
Are any of the archaeological sites sort of conducive to being able to isolate DNA from any of those skeletons?
There are certainly studies that have been done. One particular example, the site of Con Quen, there was a sort of mass burial of in a water feature in the center of town, and they were able to, by extracting DNA, determine that they were all related, right? And so there's certainly the ability to do that. A lot of the time, it depends on the state of preservation of the materials you're dealing with. In most burials, also depending on age, the depositional environment, you're gonna get quite a lot of decay. I've certainly had skeletons that we've been able to extract DNA from, and there's other skeletons that you can't get anything from, right? And so it's sort of a, hit or miss in terms of DNA. In terms of other studies dealing with the sort of isotopic remains, so that you can't essentially narrow it down to families, but you can say where a person spent the early part of their life or they spent a subsequent part of their life, right? After these teeth formed, they were in this area of the Maya lowlands. Before those teeth formed, they were actually in a different place. So you can certainly track motion through isotopic residues within teeth and bone much more readily than you can extract DNA, but also it's sort of just starting up. So if you ask me 10 years from now, I'm sure I'd have a lot more to say about it.
Is for the extraction of the DNA, is it better to have things wet or dry? Or, I mean, that jungle temperature is probably fairly hot and the decay is...
The issue is more one of soil acidity more than anything else, leading to a deterioration of bone. You get, you know, better chance of things because teeth preserve better, but it's really just, it depends on what your environment is. Like, a lot of people are essentially buried under their house floors, right? And that soil environment at Shultun is different than the soil environment at Chichen Itza, is different than the soil environment at Uxmal, right? And so that you're gonna have different levels of preservation just based on that. But if you place someone in a tomb environment, how well that tomb was built, how impervious that tomb was to the elements, right? You get some tombs that get flooded and fill with mud. You get other tombs that were hastily built and all the plaster is still wet and it all falls onto the body and essentially covers the, you know, a corpse in lime plaster doesn't lead to great preservation, right? And so those are all different things that can happen. It's not just a temperature humidity thing. There's a lot of other factors.
Thank you.
You got it.
Was that giant stone statue, where'd you find that?
This?
No. Oh, the one that looks kind of like...
Oh, okay. That's from the site of Copan in Honduras.
Uh-huh.
And that illustration was done in the 1830s. But it's still there. You can still see it today. It actually looks a little better in Catherwood's drawing, honestly, because it didn't have to endure 150 years of deterioration.
Okay. One last question.
Yep.
Do you speak Mayan?
I do not speak Mayan. I can read Mayan hieroglyphs, but I don't speak any particular Mayan languages. You know, a few words here and there, not all of them nice. It's the first words everyone teaches you. But the written language is actually essentially a lingua franca, right? It's the language of court. It's not a Maya language that's spoken today. And even in antiquity, there were probably different Mayan languages being spoken, even though folks were writing in the language of court. And so it's that language of court that I'm most familiar with.
Well, I don't suppose anyone could tell me what this means. Uxka.
Don't know.
I learned that on Age of Empires, too.
Ah, fair enough. It may or may not mean something. Yes, question.
Central Mexico, lots of the archaeological sites that have been discovered lately have been underneath churches or other buildings built by the Spaniards. It seems like most of the Mayans have been in the jungle. Is there any evidence that, for example, we may find something underneath the Spanish constructions of the buildings?
Yeah, certainly. There are Maya ruins all beneath Mérida, for example. So that was an ancient city of Tijo, right, that they built over. One of the differences is that in central Mexico and other, in Oaxaca and other places like that, essentially the Spanish are instantly interested in establishing a new order over the site of old important structures. In the Yucatan, the conquest of the Yucatan in general is very slow to develop. But you can go, for example, to the site of Izamal, which is actually where Landa himself was stationed in the Yucatan. And the principal sort of, I think, building in the large atrium that is there, which actually the Pope, actually Pope John Paul II, there's a statue to him there. That's actually built directly on top of a great big Maya pyramid, right? And so it's certainly, they did the same thing where it made sense. The difference in the Maya lowlands is large numbers of those sites were not occupied at the time that the Spanish arrived. And they were essentially back into the forest, and they didn't, there wasn't a population center for them to try and essentially take advantage of. If you go to the island of Flores, for example, in Guatemala, on Lake Petén, the island of Flores is essentially a Spanish settlement on top of the pre-existing Maya settlement that was still there in the 17th century.
You just touched on this a little bit, but your last question was, what happened to all of this? And I wondered if, you know, obviously the Spanish didn't help, but can you give a little more background?
What happened to them? You know, what's interesting is how these places fall into ruin. And there are always, so long as there are archaeologists, there will be ideas about how societies collapse. And for me, one of the interesting aspects of the collapse of ancient societies is that our current preoccupations seem to find themselves in explanations for why ancient societies collapsed, which is, if you look historically over why we thought the Maya civilization, these classic cities, you know, in the 8th century started to fall apart, if you look in the 19-teens, the predominant models for their collapse has to do with peasant revolt. Right? And that's really because that's what people are worried about in 1915. They're worried about peasant revolts, right? We find that the sort of idea of environmental degradation and the abuse of the environment, which is not to say that the Maya didn't do it, but the Maya were abusing the environment in 800 AD, and they were abusing the environment in 500 AD, and they were abusing the environment in 500 BC, right? So that's not just the reason that things fall apart. Are there droughts? Yes, there were droughts. But there were droughts throughout. There are droughts when things rise as well as when things fall. So for me, the best explanation of what happens in Maya society is that essentially, whatever the external conditions leading to societal stress are, whether that's drought, famine, disease, invasion, dissatisfaction, whatever it is, Maya cities become abandoned and abandoned. People, they stop building great big buildings for the rulers, but people don't ever really stop living in the area. But people essentially retreat into an agrarian way of life that doesn't require them to supply tribute to folks in charge that aren't doing anything, right? And so the collapse of Maya society for me has much more to do with elite Maya society no longer satisfying the needs of society at large. And so people decide that contributing to it doesn't make as much sense as it once did, right? The other thing that's important for me is that if belief is the foundation of Maya society, like what brings them all together in the first place, right? It's if belief is what brings them together, then it makes sense that lack of belief would bring them apart. And certainly for me, in any ancient society, we have a tendency to try and make them all think the same thing. Right? It makes it easy for archaeologists. If everyone thinks exactly the same thing, then we can model what they think, and it's very easy to sort of predict. But if you're talking about a city with a population of 100,000 people, and that population of 100,000 people is attending, some portion of them, is attending an event in which the king, which we know from his monument, is appearing as the god incarnate. A great majority of those people are going to be watching that event and being amazed by it, right? Because if they weren't being amazed by it, he wouldn't be doing it. But we also have to anticipate that in that 100,000 people, there are folks that say, yeah, I saw him do this last Thursday. You know, and so that there's going to be a diversity of belief. And it's that diversity of belief that responds differently when sort of events happen, whether that's invasion or drought or, you know, any other sort of environmental factor in the exterior. When those things happen, then a person reacts to that. And they either react to that by saying, you know what, this guy has kept us here for all this time and it's gonna come back, or there's folks that are like, yeah, I'm out. And one of the remarkable things about the Maya world is it was never an empire. There was never a single solitary sort of locus of power. So that whenever anything starts to decline in one place, you can bet that it's rising someplace else, right? And so for me, it's a model more similar to, you know, the collapse of Detroit rather than, right, some sort of external factor. Folks move away because there's better opportunities elsewhere. And then some folks come back. And that's sort of the sort of ebb and flow of Maya society. It's the same thing with any other. One more question. Yeah.
I'm curious. You're sitting there in bat poop. You have your great revelation.
Yeah.
But you're not excited because you think you're going to die. Meanwhile, yeah, your colleagues are looking for the shower vines.
Yeah.
Can you fill in the gap? What happened next a little more?
What happened next was I took a picture, and I went and sat in a hammock and didn't tell anybody about it for fear that something bad would result. Then we spent the night. We did not have, they didn't really find water per se. They found a fluid. And I use that in the physical term, fluid. Like, I guess it could flow across a surface. But it was sort of a gummy resin, which they filtered through my shirt. And, you know, Bernie had brought emergency rations. He had, this whole time, had been saying that in case of emergency, he had supplies. And this finally, on the end of day two, I guess, was when he produced the emergency rations. And the emergency rations was one container of crab-flavored cup of noodle. I'm going to let that sink in. It's like it only requires one ingredient. Now, I would also say that since that time, I have never seen before nor since crab-flavored cup of noodle. So I actually have no idea where he got this or how long he had been waiting for just such an emergency. And then we had to walk out. And that day three, we argued as to whether we should walk out in a straight line to our vehicles, which was 8 kilometers, or whether we should go back the way we came, 22. The vote was 4-2. To go back the way we came. And so on day three, we walked 22 kilometers. We hadn't had liquid in 2 days. And at a certain point, we got back to the vehicles. I mean, we all collapsed at one point. We got back to a place that was 3 kilometers from the vehicles, and the first four, our party had sort of split up, and the first three that got there were all unconscious and in the path. And at that point, I lost heart, and I said to Anatolio Lopez, who had been Ian Graham's assistant for 35 years, I said, convinced that Anatolio was going to survive, I was like, you know, Anatolio, I'm not making it out, but my wife will get some consolation if you tell her that I died in my hammock. And so I hung a hammock in the trees and sat down in a hammock to die. At that point, I will say that it seemed really improbable to me that I would die of thirst in a rainforest. But of course, anyone that spends time in that part of the forest, means it's not actually a rainforest. It's actually a seasonal desertic forest. And so for part of the year, it doesn't have any water at all. And this happened to be that part of the year. There was no water in leaves, there was no water in vines, there was no water in roots, there was just no water. I mean, that's just the way it was. There was always the stories that if you're dying of thirst, right, in case of absolute emergency, right, you've all heard these stories, you can drink your own urine. Yeah, there's only one problem with this. You don't have any urine. It's like, you haven't peed for a day and a half. And I was sitting in a hammock thinking, who would ever pull this off? Like, the forethought that that would require. Be like, I might want this in a day or two. It's like, that's just never going to happen. And I will say that if you ever find yourself in a hammock in the middle of the forest, thinking, damn it, if only I had two-day-old urine to drink, it's probably about as close to death as you want to get. Anatolio actually found a fruit that grows in the forest, in the bajos, in the sort of thorny scrub forest. And we ate some, and we walked out. And I clearly wasn't thinking 3 days into dehydration. At a certain point, driving, Bernie and those guys left. They got back to the vehicles and like a rat out of an aqueduct. They were gone. And Anatolio and I were left to drive out, not actually knowing necessarily the road back. So we just started to drive. The most memorable part of this drive was at a certain point, I looked over and Anatolio was gone. And I thought, how did that happen? So I stopped and I reversed and I found Anatolio about 500 yards behind me. He had fallen out of the vehicle. A vine had actually ripped off the door handle of the Land Rover and the door had swung open and he had fallen out. And I hadn't noticed. And I just kept driving. At a certain point, he wasn't there anymore. And so I actually went back to find him. And he was clearly not all there either, because he was digging in the brush on the side of the road looking for the door handle. And when I was like, Anatolio, you got to get back in the car, he's like, Ian's going to be really mad we lost his door handle. I was like, I'm pretty sure he'll be okay with it. I will buy another door handle. And he got back in the car. There was a point at which, you know, that where I came into Washaktun. Washaktun is a town, right? It's a village. There are like 65 families that live there. The road to Shultun is just south of Washaktun. And so when we came out to that road, our options were to turn right to drive literally 50 meters to find a restaurant, small hotel, right? Or turn left and drive 23 kilometers to try and get out of Tikal Park, and then another, you know, 40 kilometers to El Remate. And so that's what we did. So that's, you just don't think. And then actually, to be honest, I have no idea what happens after that. I don't have any memory of what takes place after that. I got back to the United States somehow. I showed up at my mother-in-law's house in New Haven, Connecticut on a Sunday morning at 6 a.m. No recollection of how I got there. I did, however, know that I stopped at the office in Cambridge because I put a picture of the San Bartolo mural on the desktop of everyone's computer in the Corpus office with no explanation at all. And then that was it. I don't remember doing it. I just know the result of my actions. So I still don't have those days. I lost about 4 days. So that's the end.